Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 6th day of April, Anno Domini 2024, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Sound Bites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Chris Horn today.
Today. And at 6 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose, kick off your shoes, don't get the blues. Have you paid your dues? Here comes the news. Windows 11 had a rocky start, but it's been getting better lately. But there's still plenty of good reasons to stay on Windows 10 if you're comfortable with it. Unfortunately, security isn't one of them. The operating system will stop getting updates in 2025 unless you pay for extended security updates. And pay a lot. Late last year, we learned Microsoft will offer paid security updates past the end of full support on October 14th, 2025. But the company didn't mention any prices. Now it has, and you might want to brace yourself. For educational institutions and businesses who want extended security updates, or ESU as Microsoft calls them, on Windows 10, they'll need to purchase a license similar to a standard Windows key, which will then unlock the updates. Standard, regular, everyday customers, you and me, are SOL, severely out of luck. The price? $61 a year. Per computer. And that's just for the first year. The price will double every consecutive year for a maximum of 3 years. That would make year two, starting in October of 2026, $122. And year three, October 2027, a whopping $244 per computer. What's more, you can't just hop on the bandwagon later to save some dough. If you decide to enroll in the ESU program after October of 2026, you'll still be charged for the first year as well as the second year. Enroll after October of 2027, you'll be charged for the first and second year. Whenever you get the update, you'll be paying a total of $427 for security support through the end of the three-year program. Licenses can be redeemed online in a browser through Windows 365 or with an old-fashioned 25-digit code. Businesses can get a 25% discount if they buy volume ESU licenses through the Windows Auto Patch system, bringing the per PC price down to $45 for year one. But it's still an expensive proposition, especially if you want to keep a network of hundreds of PCs ticking over nicely. Needless to say, Windows 11 users will continue to receive free security updates along with regular maintenance and feature patches they're used to. And Microsoft is really hoping you'll upgrade if you haven't already. Though previous patch versions of Windows 11 have gone out of support, there's no end-of-life date set for the operating system as of yet. Windows 12, or whatever Microsoft ends up calling it, is still on the horizon. When the mafia does it, they call it the protection racket. When Microsoft does it, it's called the cost of doing business.
Uh-huh.
So our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that's bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is 3 years of Windows 10 support will cost $427. And your choices are, is that all? Well worth it. Still better than going to Windows 11. Going commando, baby. Tell me more about Linux. And win what now? So far, we've got 23 votes. And tell me more about Linux is just ahead of win what now? Followed by going commando, baby. Is that all well worth it? And still better than going to Windows 11 as one vote.
But what are the people?
So give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415.
So what do the people do? Like, I've got one PC. It's relatively new. It's only maybe a year and a half old. And when Windows 11 was doing the automatic update, you know, it came out, my machine said, oh, sorry, yours doesn't qualify, doesn't meet the specs. So I can't put Windows 11 on it. And I sure as heck, you know.
Well, Microsoft's answer would be, buy a new computer, you piker. Exactly. But in the real world, you can stick Linux on it and
go along perfectly happily. Which I have done on one that I'm using and love it.
So Microsoft basically is saying, we're done with Windows 10. We're done supporting it. We're done using it.
Because they don't make any money off of it.
They're not making any money off it, and they don't like that. And so they want everybody on Windows 11. Well, also, Windows 10 is just, you know, they're spending a lot of resources keeping that operating system running, and they don't want to be bothered anymore. The problem is, for the average user, much of the underlying code of Windows 10 is identical to the underlying code in Windows 11. Mm-hmm. So as time goes on, if they find and fix a security issue in Windows 11, Windows 10 probably has the same security issue and will not get a fix. So you can guarantee, not maybe, but guarantee some robot will find your machine at some point and you will definitely get yourself owned.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a when. And, you know, you want to roll the dice, that's on you. But don't, you know, what's going to happen is we're going to get calls where I think I got owned. What do I do? Stop using Windows 10. That's the answer. That's the only answer left.
Yeah.
It cannot be fixed.
Well, it's just like, you know, people want to improve, you know, the performance of their machines and everything else. And we keep telling them, you know, hello, it's a 7-8-year-old computer. There's nothing we can do about it, you know. You can only patch a leaky pipe so many times, and you're going to run out of duct tape.
That's exactly right.
And I think with Windows 11, they've got the new hardware requirements, TPM 2.0, more modern CPU. It's because, I think mostly, because of the higher bar of security features they can put into the operating system, whether that's something you as a consumer want or not.
Right.
At the enterprise level, that's the line they're drawing.
Right. You will not, as an end user, be able to get this, even if you wanted to pay the $244, did I say? $244.
Oh, I thought it was four.
For year three, the total is $427.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you wanted to pay the $427, as a consumer, you don't even get the choice. You can't do it.
Yeah.
It's only businesses and educational institutions. Now, I ran an educational institution for 20 years, and I can tell you right now that it's not going to make them happy to pay $427 per computer to keep them up and running. So they're just all – well, I'm sure Dave has already moved them to Windows 11 anyway. But if I were still there, I would be saying, yeah, we're going to Windows 11. You don't like it? Too bad. You pay the $427.
Yeah.
We'll gladly take that out of your budget if you want to keep Windows 10. But if you want, that's fair. If you want to do that, we will happily pay that money for you. But I believe you can probably only buy it in bulk as an educational institution. So that's a problem. What did I do?
No, we should talk about what's going on right now.
Yeah. Well, right. And that's the important thing. So I think you need to know that we here at Soundbites are participating in the current Jazz 90.1 pledge drive. It's only twice a year. Yeah, look, we've talked about this so many times. This is a public radio station, and that means that the cost of running this station is borne by the listeners. We're not a big organization. We don't have national funding, state funding, local funding. When we say we're public radio and that our members are the people who support us, we ain't kidding. That's how it works here. And if you like this show, if you like this station being on the air, you need to contribute. You need to become a member. You need to pledge for us right now. And it's real easy to do. Just give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. You can pledge at all kinds of levels there, and you can see that. The easiest way to do it, honestly, is just go to Jazz 90.1, jazz901.org, and hit the big donate now button. It's kind of hard to miss. So if you go to that, and Dave seems to be banging his forehead on the mic. Sorry.
not easy.
It's not easy, but he manages it, and it's a good thing. If you head on over to jazz901.org, hit the big donate now button, you will see that it's easy to donate. There are multiple levels, from $35 up to $1,000 and more. And you pick a level that you like. Pay attention also to the Jazz-O-Matic level. Jazz-O-Matic means that for the period of 1 year, we take whatever amount you like at a minimum of $10, whatever amount you like out of your checking account automatically, or your credit card actually automatically. And it means that for a small bite every month, you get the big premiums. And we do have premiums. There's shirts and hats and things, and it's all really kind of wonderful. You can see it all on the site. The most popular level appears to be the $90.10 level. Get it? 90, 10, 901, Jazz 901. Look, you get it. But at whatever level, you want to, donate, we need that money. We need to keep this station on the air. Look, we've been doing this show for 30 odd years.
33 years.
Yeah. And it's great. We love coming to you and helping you. But we can't do it without a radio station underneath us. It's kind of hard for us to just open a window and shout. So it doesn't get very far. The radio station is what keeps us on the air. And it's not just us. There is so much good music on this station. I'll tell you, I keep it on in the background all day long. It's great music. It's soothing music. It's comfortable music. It's just great, and you need to be part of this station. If you are part of this station, God bless you, and thank you from the bottoms of our hearts. And if you want to increase your membership, that's really great.
Yeah.
If you're not a member, why not? I mean, you listen to us every week. You get free advice from us every single week. All we ask in return is that twice a year, we come to you and ask you to become a member. That's not onerous. It is not difficult. I know everybody hides behind, well, I don't have any money, and it's a terrible economy. You can't afford $10. You can't afford $35. Nonsense. You bought $15,000 worth of equipment. You could send us one-tenth of that, $150, and still manage to live. So,
and how much we save them just if they had to go to a repair shop.
Right.
And what it would cost them just for an hour or two of the repair services, and that's not even including the parts, if there's any parts that need to be replaced.
Let's look at it this way. At the moment, Microsoft is valuing Windows 10 support at $61 for the first year.
Mm-hmm.
You get your Windows 10 support from us, send us $61. Do it. It's there easy enough to do. Send us $50. Look at the discount you just got.
And it's a tax write-off.
So for most people, we're not giving out tax advice here. You should talk to professionals.
Yeah, don't about listen to that. Us.
But theoretically, at least, there's a tax thing. So give us a call. You'll talk to Michael. Michael is on the phones. Tell him we said hi. Tell him thank you for his volunteering. It's great that he is doing this. And give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 800-790-0415.
And that's what we've gotten into, excuse me, for a number of years. You know, like you said, we do this show every year, every Saturday. We're usually here 52 weeks out of the year, unless Christmas or New Year falls on a Saturday. Otherwise, we're here giving you the support that you want. And, guess what? Because Nick's broken this news to me before. It was a little shocking.
Yeah.
We don't get paid.
Yeah, sorry.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
It's right. You know those checks you haven't been getting?
Still going to get them.
You're still not going to get them.
Yeah.
Just as many checks as I did before.
But, we take
you
the time.
You know what? You deserve a raise.
Thank you. Yeah. We'll double it.
Double it.
We take the time out of our Saturdays. right at the middle of the day. Think about it. You know, it's at noon, and we're here until 2 o'clock. It's prime time. Rob was gracious enough to let us come on air and, you know, do this show. So to kind of pay it back or pay it forward, you know, ante up and do whatever you can to help keep us on the air so we can do year 34 and 35.
Right.
Without it.
Our spouses don't want us home. So, you know, right. We got to go somewhere.
Oh, my wife would love it if I were at the public market pouring coffee for her. But instead, I'm here. And all we ask is that you become a member of this station. Like I said, it's not onerous. Let's not pretend you can't afford a few bucks to keep us on the air.
Right.
So please make the pledge, make the call. 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or pledge securely online at jazz901.org. And while you're doing that, we will talk to Mark from Greece, New York. Thanks for being patient, Mark. What's up?
Nick, with your awesome power, please do not blow out the sun.
I put a post on Facebook that said, did you feel the earth move today? That was just a taste of my power. Give me all my demands or I will blot out the sun. What's up, Mark?
I just wanted to tell you that I heard, and I was listening to some tech shows on YouTube, that for the first time, it'll probably be in a week or two or maybe in a month, Microsoft will offer for the first time for us mortals to be able to pay them money for support.
Well, yeah, we were just talking about that. The thing is that Microsoft has said that next year when Windows 10 goes off of free support, you will have to pay for that support if you want to keep Windows 10.
Yep.
The problem is you won't get it. It is only for businesses and educational institutions.
Well, from what I heard, like I said, from the one tech show I listened to, this will be the first time they're going to offer it to non-businesses.
And that's educational institutions. They have said it will not be available for individuals.
And who wants to pay that kind of money for that anyways?
Well, it ends up being $427 for 3 years of support.
Way too much.
I think we might wind up in a situation where it used to be Office 365. Now they've got Microsoft 365. They just want you to pay a subscription per month, per year. And that's what you need to do maybe to run Windows 10 a little bit longer because they haven't figured out what the backlash is really going to be.
Right. Part of this may just be the flag up the flagpole.
Right. This could be the – we give them the bad news and then as a favor –
They let
you pay to keep on, say, on Windows 10 forever.
Well, we've been saying for years that what Microsoft is telling their investors, and you do not lie to the investors. They've been telling the investors that what they want is a subscription service where Windows is basically run in the cloud.
Yeah.
And you're just a terminal up to the cloud.
Yeah.
And they still apparently can't make it work. But that's their plan. And as part of that, they're making it both difficult and expensive and unsecure to run older versions of Windows. They want you to pay every year for the privilege of running Windows.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
I don't know about you, but if they go to subscriptions, I am subscriptioned out already.
Well, but the point is, if you don't have a subscription, you can't run Windows.
Right. But, you know, man, that's probably the time to go to an alternative because another subscription is just another subscription.
Right. Right.
You know, you only can pay for so many subscriptions.
Well, exactly.
And, you know, and these days I love going and working on my computer, but I get more fun watching other things that maybe aren't even primetime TV, but other things.
Right.
And, you know, maybe I'll go back to Linux again. I used it for quite a few years on an older computer I had till it died.
Yep. Well, this is what we're telling people. If you don't want to pay a subscription, you have to look at alternative operating systems. And right now, those are Macs and Linux. And if you've got an older PC sitting around that you're not using, throw Linux on it and start playing with it now, and so that you don't have to panic when you suddenly can't run Windows anymore.
Yep, I've got a 12-year-old Gateway, but
Gateway.
Yeah, it was near the end before they stopped selling. You know, they went to Acer,
right?
And then after that, slowly they cleaned out all the Gateways, and I still have this PC. It still has the original hard drive in it, but it's being used as a data drive because I put an SSD in it.
Sure.
And this thing is still running like a top.
Yep.
And I'll tell you, that would take Linux quick and easy.
Yeah, and you will find, well, you already know this, but for everybody else, you'll find that Linux is not so very different from Windows. Yes, some things are in a different place, and yes, sometimes you have to use a different program than what you're used to. But as we've said so many times, it's like buying a new car. You still know how to drive, you just don't know where the radio is. But after a couple of weeks, you figure out where the radio is, and it's like you never didn't know. You just turn that radio on when you get in the car, and you're on your way.
And remember, wine works 85% of the time.
Yep.
So, you know, you can use some of your programs. Some of them might work with wine. Some of them won't, especially older ones. But
right. And what Mark is talking about, wine is a program that lets you run Windows programs. So you can install a window. Now, you don't have to. There are equivalents every Windows program. They have a different name. For example, instead of Microsoft Office, you can run LibreOffice. Instead of Edge, you run Chromium or Chrome. So you can, but if you really have a program that must be run in Wine and in Windows, you can almost always run it under Wine under Linux.
Yep, I had very good luck with it running some programs I was using at the time.
Yep.
When I was, can't remember what flavor of Linux I was using at the time. It was probably one form of Ubuntu, but, you know, it worked great. So I think that's what I might do is go back because, like I said, I wouldn't have stopped using it other than that computer, you know, died.
Right. And you know what? You're right, Mark. This may, and as Chris said, this might be, you know, running it up the flagpole and see what happens. And if enough people say, screw it, I'm going to try Linux, they may change their minds. But right now, this is their plan. And the reality is that you're not Microsoft's customer.
Mm-hmm.
Microsoft is a publicly traded customer, so a company. So their customers are the shareholders. We're the product.
Yep.
And whatever it takes to make the product palatable to the customer, Microsoft will do.
That's right. That's how most companies that are traded, our cable company, same thing.
Yep, it's exactly the same way.
Same thing. And remember, if you do go to Linux and you want to use something else portable, the Chromebook is a nice alternative to use when you want to go portable.
Yeah, exactly. They're inexpensive, they're easy to use, and they do, you know, what 90% of the people do is on their browser anyway.
Right.
So, you know, you win. That's how it works. All right, thanks, Mark.
I will be contributing, but I can't contribute till next week, unfortunately.
Well, you're in luck because the fun drive will still be going next week.
Yep, I will be. I'm just got to get through this weekend, and then I will be golden again.
Excellent. Thank you, Mark.
Okay, we'll talk to you later.
Yep, happy eclipsing.
Thanks.
Look, we're here for 3 weeks, but I know you and you know you. If you put it off, you'll forget about it. So make that call and make that pledge. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415 and securely online at jazz901.org. We're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Chris Horn, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 29 minutes after the hour. It's Soundbites right here on Member Supported. Did you catch that? Member Supported, Jazz 90.1. See you in a few.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm still legally Chris Horn.
Well, for now, yeah.
And at 36 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we are in the middle of a pledge drive. So make that call. Make that pledge. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. Or pledge securely online at jazz901.org. And in the meantime, I'll read the news. I can't tell you how many people sent me this this particular news item.
Love it.
Linux, the most widely used open source operating system in the world, narrowly escaped a massive cyber attack over Easter weekend, all thanks to one volunteer. This is very reminiscent of the Cuckoo. Did you ever read The Cuckoo's Egg?
Oh my gosh, yes. That's required reading.
Yeah, it's very similar to this.
Oh yeah.
A backdoor had been inserted into a recent release of a Linux compression format called xzutils, a tool that is little known outside the Linux world, but is used in nearly every Linux distribution to compress large files, making them easier to transfer. If it had spread more widely, an untold number of systems could have been left compromised for years. And the culprit has been working on the project out in the open. The vulnerability inserted into Linux's remote login only exposed itself to a single key so that it could hide from scans of public computers. The majority of the world's computers would be vulnerable and no one would know. The story of the XZ backdoor's discovery starts in the early morning of March 29th as San Francisco-based Microsoft developer Andres Freund, which I'm sure I've mispronounced, posted on Mastodon and sent an email to OpenWall security mailing list with the heading Backdoor and Upstream XZLibLZMA Leading to SSH Server Compromise. Freund, who volunteers as a maintainer for PostgreSQL, a Linux-based database, noticed a few strange things over the past few weeks while running tests. Encrypted logins in LibLZMA, part of the XZ compression library, were using up a ton of CPU. None of the performance tools he used revealed anything. Freund wrote on Mastodon about that, and this immediately made him suspicious. And he remembered an odd complaint from a Postgres user a couple of weeks earlier about Valgrind, Linux's program that checks for memory errors. I'm sorry, was I supposed to be speaking English? I forget something.
Automated testing.
Yeah, exactly. After some sleuthing, Freund eventually discovered what was wrong. The upstream LZ repository and the XZ tarballs had been backdoored, noted Freund in his email. The malicious code was in versions 5.6.0 and 5.6.1 of the XZ tools and libraries. Shortly after, enterprise open source software company Red Hat sent out an emergency security alert for users of Fedora Rawhide and Fedora Linux 40. Although a beta version of Debian contained compromised packages, its security team acted swiftly to revert them. Freund later identified the person who submitted the malicious code as one of two maintainers of XZUtils, known as GIAT75 or GIATAN. GIAT75 was a familiar name. They'd worked side-by-side with the original developer of the .xz file format, Lasse Collins, for a while. The XZ backdoor incident and its aftermath are an example of both the beauty of open source and a striking vulnerability in the Internet's infrastructure. The XZ fiasco has shown how dependent on unpaid volunteers can cause major problems. Trillion-dollar corporations expect free and urgent support from volunteers. Details of who is behind GIAT75, how they executed their plan, and the extent of the damage are being unearthed by an army of developers and cybersecurity professionals, both on social media and online forums. But that happens without direct financial support from many of the companies and organizations who benefit from being able to use secure software. Linux volunteers fix bugs faster than paid professionals at Microsoft or Apple. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415.
So I am fascinated by this because it wasn't just a hack that happened over a week. This person, if it's even a real person,
right,
contributed to many projects for years, patiently, and
played the long game.
Slowly, and used social engineering. There's like fake accounts that applied guilt pressure on the existing maintainers for XZ or lib LZMA.
The main
to get this person
yep.
in a position of authority and eventually take over.
Yeah, the main guy had some physical problems and posted that he was yeah. unable to work in a timely manner and that some other people were gonna have to pick up some slack, and a whole bunch of probably fake accounts or at yeah. least sponsored yeah. accounts.
Right.
Pressured him to put this Jia Tan on the main maintainer list so that he had the authority to upload changes. Up to then, only the main one guy had the authority to upload changes.
Yeah. So the idea that this person, this hacker, was patient and potentially did normal work
yep.
for years on this and not a trivial amount of time.
Yeah, and he did good work or they wouldn't have let him become a maintainer. I mean, yeah. he did mediocre or bad work.
Yeah. So I mean, I work for a security company.
Right.
When this came out, I was part of like the response team. Like, what are we going to do about this? Because this is called a supply chain attack. Where you attack the source that are the building blocks, the Legos that go into your finished product, like Linux.
Yep, yep.
And it's the thing that big enterprises, that governments are terrified of. Because the patience, the amount of time this hacker put in, really lends itself towards state-sponsored hacking.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's the buzz. Everybody's looking for proof or disproof for this kind of thing. But it's I think it's going to change spending at the enterprise level.
Well, I think
because this is the first one in at least recent memory where it was a supply chain attack. And it was escalated because I think that Valgrind utility, they were talking about making a change to it, and it would have discovered all of these stepping stones this bad actor, this guy had put into these different projects to make his hack work.
Right. Yeah, it was quite a scary thing. It's been averted.
By chance. And ironically, by a volunteer from Microsoft
yeah, exactly.
helping Linux.
Exactly.
In my lifetime, if I would have said that would happen, I
Right, you would have said, well, that's science fiction, and
yes.
it's bad science fiction.
Right, this is a terrible sci-fi novel.
Exactly.
I don't believe any part of it.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Michael. Where are you calling from, Michael?
I'm in Gates.
Gates, New York. What's up?
I'm trying to network two laptops. I'm using Spectrum for the backbone, and I'm trying to map them as a network drive, and I can't seem to pull it off.
Is this on Wi-Fi?
Yeah.
And it's
and these are both Windows machines?
Yeah, Windows 10 maybe?
They're both Windows 11 on both machines.
Okay.
So it's I've done this a bunch of times, but yeah. every time I do it, I just start clicking. And Windows will usually help me. Like, you have to enable file sharing on your network.
Right.
Windows 10, 11.
Both hard drives, you got to right click on it and go into properties and set up sharing and give it full access.
And you may have to go into advanced sharing.
Usually it's computer management.
I think Windows these days will ask you. So if you go and click on, if you're in Windows Explorer and you click on network, there's usually like a yellow bar that'll go across the top of the File Explorer. And it's really Windows saying, hey, if you want to do this, you have to enable file sharing on your network. And it might yeah. also say that this is a public network instead of a private network. So if you go into it, it doesn't have to. You probably want it to be private. If it's your home Wi-Fi,
yeah.
You can go into settings, network, and then kind of like in the top, in the middle, there's settings for the network, and you can say that this is a private network. And once it's private, and you do that on both computers, then file sharing between the computers should start to work.
Yeah, because you got to go into the network settings, and if you don't need passwords to be set between your network, you can turn that off so it doesn't bug you each time you try to connect to that other computer and its hard drive asking you for the password.
And I think if you're logged in with your Microsoft account on both computers,
they got to be in the same group too.
Right. It should.
Gotta
it
be
should
in the
just
same
work.
Group.
But by
right, I've also put up an article, a link to an article from Microsoft on file sharing over network in Windows. And it's for local sharing. It's not for sharing over the internet to some other house. It's for sharing within your own network.
Intranet.
Yeah, and I think even before you start thinking about like, oh, do I want to share this folder or this whole drive or whatever, if you go to network, the first step is to be able to see the other computer as an object, as an icon on the network. If you can do that, then you can, you know, then it's a matter of changing your sharing settings.
Right, but they do have to be in the same group to be seen.
Right, same work group.
Work group, you're right.
Same work group. Okay, I haven't run into the work group. How do I?
Windows 10 and 11, I think by default, they don't really make that setting
you
accessible.
You can go into the control panel under system. And in there is where you can then see, it'll give you the computer name and the workgroup name and all that stuff.
The easiest way to get to it is open the settings app, and then in the search bar type workgroup.
Okay.
Yep.
And
they're
you'll
almost
see
certainly the same. I would say it's more likely.
I forget when they made the change, but it used to be one workgroup name, and then they changed it to another. And I don't remember if that was between 8 and 10 or between 10 and 11.
Yeah, because originally it was work group.
Yeah, I think it's back to work group as the default everybody. Even that you don't really see. I think it's the private versus public network is the most likely thing.
And I think what you're talking about, Nick, is in Windows 8, they changed it. Because they were changing Windows 8, the whole look and everything else. And
they learned some
tablet
lessons.
Tablet look and all this other junk. And they changed the work group name, and that was messing everybody up.
Yeah.
See,
so I think with those two pieces of information, how to get to the work group name and the article that I posted, you should be able to find what you need.
Would that be on the Soundbite website?
Yes. Yep. It's currently the first article on the latest links heard on the show. It's called File Sharing Over a Network in Windows. Okie doke?
Okay.
All right.
Thank
Thanks.
Yep.
Yeah.
When Windows 10 first came out, that private network versus public network thing was buried in the settings and not easy to find. But current Windows 10, it's really right at the top if you go into your network settings.
Yep. It's a very long time that Windows has been able to share things over a network, but it's also been a very long time when it was difficult.
Yeah.
And they are trying to make it a little easier. And sometimes they do it right. Who knows? All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Kevin from Rochester, New York. What's up, Kevin?
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm actually giving you an update because I called last week and I had a question. And so I've got the update that it actually worked. I called about my Linux laptop. I had a Dell laptop. I couldn't update the BIOS through Linux.
Right.
Because there wasn't a battery. I didn't have a battery installed while also having it plugged in.
Right.
So the Dell updater was, I guess for a safety measure, was telling me that it wouldn't let me do that in case I lost power during the update. It would brick the thing.
Right.
That's fascinating. That makes total sense. I don't think I've seen that happen before.
Well, I figured if it was plugged in, it'd be fine. And then when I rebooted it to install it, it started installing, and then it said inadequate power. You must have power plugged in and a battery. And the problem was it wasn't detecting the battery.
Right.
It was a different problem. But anyway, the advice you gave me, Nick, was to save the, actually, go to the Dell website, download the Windows EXE BIOS updater for that device.
Right.
And then when I rebooted it, I hit F12, got to the boot menu. There was an option for flash BIOS update, and I had the file on my flash drive, yeah. And the computer saw that, and it even had a little status readout where it said power inadequate. But then there was a little text for options, a text field where I typed in /force it.
Right.
And then the power status changed from inadequate to forced. And then I updated it and it went through and it worked totally fine. It updated the BIOS finally.
Cool. Good. Excellent. And yeah, you are running Linux. So it's a little counterintuitive that you would download the EXE file for Windows and that it would work. But the thing is, you're updating from the BIOS, and Linux hasn't even started yet, so it does make sense when you think about it.
Doesn't know anything.
Yeah, it saw the file too on my flash drive right away.
Right. So, mm-hmm.
You know, and then the funny thing after that is, since I've updated the BIOS, now it detects the battery.
You're kidding?
No. So it was like a catch-22. I couldn't update it because it didn't detect the battery, and it didn't detect the battery probably because the BIOS was old.
That's very funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's very funny. Well, I'm glad it worked out for you, Kevin.
Yeah, well, and I just donated earlier today when your show started. So.
God love you. We appreciate
Thank you very
that.
Much,
Thank you, Kevin.
Well, thanks a lot, guys. You deserve it. So
thank you.
And keep it up. Talk
thanks.
To you later.
Take care.
Okay, bye.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen, another unsolicited testimonial. And you can join Kevin. It's easy enough to do, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or pledge securely online at jazz901.org. Only you can decide how much our support is worth to you, but I got to think it's worth something. So make that call and make that pledge.
The reason it goes into Windows is because of that flash drive is formatted in a Windows formatting configuration.
Right.
So it's doing it as FAT32. So when you put your file on there, it's actually booting up in a Windows environment.
Right.
When you put that flash drive in, because like you said, it doesn't know Linux. It doesn't know squat.
The BIOS can read the drive, and that's all it needs.
Yeah, that's all it needed.
At least the Dells, right? Like the Dells definitely have the setting to say allow BIOS over a USB stick.
Yeah, he had a Dell Latitude.
Perfect.
Yeah.
How often is it that the answer is to help your computer help itself?
Yeah. Right.
I'm so impressed that the battery now works.
Yeah. That's great. And yes, one of the things we often forget is that the BIOS gets updated too. And so, and Dell is doing it right. If it cannot detect a battery, the one thing that is guaranteed 110% to brick your computer dying in the middle of an update,
flash.
Of a BIOS update.
Yeah.
And so it makes sense that they would say no, you really need belt and suspenders here, folks.
Mm-hmm.
Except, I mean, the same problem if you have a workstation or a server or something without a battery.
Right.
It's the same scenario.
Right. And so the ability to say, do it anyway, and then, you know, the Dell is essentially saying, on your head be it.
Yeah.
We'll do it, but it's on you.
Yeah. You better best know what you're doing.
Yep.
Because we're not going to be responsible if you try to do otherwise.
Yep. So, it's a Dell is doing it right. There is no question that Dell is doing it right. So we're glad we could help Kevin out. We actually got one right. That goes in the books.
Yeah.
Good for us. Look at the advice we're giving people. Look at the help we give people. And you get help from us, whether it's something that directly impacts you today, or it's something that you'll keep in your head until you need it, or it's just a cool thing you learned today. You should become a member. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or pledge securely online at jazz901.org. And while you all talk to Michael and do that, we're going to talk to Dave from Canandaigua, New York. What's up, Dave?
Oh, nothing good. Got a couple questions here. The new version of Thunderbird, well, I just upgraded to Windows 10. That was an awful experience by itself. But anyway, with Thunderbird, when I create an email and I paste a link, it's popping up like graphics now, the images that are probably on the web page that it leads to.
Yep.
Right.
Can I turn that off? I just want to see the link. I don't want to see the pictures.
I bet you can. Thunderbird has a ton of settings, and off the top of my head, I don't remember what that would be. But worst case scenario is you should be able to tell Thunderbird not to make HTML email, to do plain text email, and that would get rid of any preview. And it could be that the preview for that link is just for you, and it's not really putting it into the email.
Yeah. I tried the HTML only, and that messed something else up. I can't remember what it was.
Okay, so try this. You can paste in Thunderbird without any formatting, which would include HTML code, and that's that's Alt-Shift-V. Either go to Edit, Paste, Special, or just Alt-Shift-V, which should do that.
Yeah, right click does it too. Paste unformatted text.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
But it still comes up with a preview if you do that?
Yeah, actually. Well, I'm trying to remember I'm too old to remember that many things all at once. But I can work around it for now or whatever. I'm just curious if there was it's probably in those where you go into the listing, there's a gazillion and one things config, yeah. Probably. Well, I can live with it.
You know what? It's got to be called preview something.
I'll try that. Yeah. I can't log into my Microsoft account now that I'm up to Windows 10. It wants me to log in to do some stuff. And I've tried everything I can think of to, you know, I keep sending in, they ask him more and more questions and all. And I'm going to assume that I just got to use a different email address and create a new account. That's my best guess.
Unfortunately, once Microsoft thinks you're some kind of hacker, getting off that list is almost impossible.
Yeah, probably easier just to use a different email address and start over.
Yeah, but it's not impossible. It's just almost impossible.
Am I cut off?
Well, you're going to be. So why don't you stay on the line, Dave, and we'll get back to you after the break.
All right.
Yep. All right. We are going to take a quick break. That music tells us the first hour of this show is over, but do not despair. There's a whole nother hour of the longest running computer show in the known universe coming your way. Another hour of Dave Enright, and thank heaven, another hour of Chris Horn, and another hour of me, Nick Francesco, and you. And you know what you can do during this break? You can become a member. It's easy enough to do. Just call 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. You'll talk to Michael, who's a wonderful human being and would appreciate your call. If you don't want to talk to a human being, you can pledge securely online at jazz901.org. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Go and take a bio break, get a beverage of choice, and we'll be back with a whole lot more sound bites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. See you on the other side.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
This is WGMC Greece Rochester, a public service of the Greece Central School District and official media partner of this year's CGI Rochester International Jazz Festival. Jazz 90.1.
On Instagram at WGMC Jazz 901.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm not Steve Ray. I don't care what you tell me.
What?
I'm Chris Horn.
Oh, you'll be Chris Horn today.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're calling him Chris Horn today.
You can call me Steve.
Hey, it's your choice. Whatever you like. He'll answer to most any loud noise. All right. Are you still there, Dave?
I'm still here.
I found it during the break. Ha-ha.
Uh-huh.
What you do is you go into settings. Under Edit Settings, and under that you click on Thunderbird Settings, and under that you click on Composition.
Ah, okay.
And under Composition, one of the choices is Add Link Previews when pasting URLs.
Ah, great.
And you uncheck that, obviously.
Yeah. I haven't had that. I updated that like when I went up to Windows 10, so there's all kinds of new goodies in there.
Right.
Yeah. So my next question is asking for a friend. This is a Mac question.
Dave, he doesn't have a Mac, so okay. We'll let it slide this time.
Yeah.
For I'm a friend, wink, her. Wink.
Yeah. I'm trying to help her use Bitwarden. So we installed Bitwarden, the desktop app, and also added the extension to Safari. So, and as near as I can tell, everything's in there the way it's supposed to be. When you go to a site to log in, when you click on the Thunderbird little icon up on the out in the top bar there, it just gets the spinning wheel, and I have tried everything I can think of to work around it. And I wondered if you had any insights on that one.
So that's Bitwarden, which is an antivirus?
Yeah.
No, it's a password manager.
Oh, okay. And you have the plugin for Safari installed, but you're also using Firefox, and Firefox probably has an extension to install also.
Well, right. When I say, well, maybe you should just use Firefox. Well, I've used this, and I don't want to change. And that's the thing, is it will come to that. And that's one of the things I will do on this mission is to see if it works in Firefox so I will know that the problem is actually in Safari. But there's only so much I can do with some people in one day.
Sure. Well, one of the things you need to do in Safari is open the Safari menu and select Settings. Then there's an Extensions page.
Yeah, there's an Extensions tab at the top.
And then you want to check the Bitwarden checkbox and make sure it's turned on.
Been there, done that, yeah.
Yeah, so,
okay, so that's one start, of the this is start.
Other things I've noticed with Safari extensions is that if you update the app, the extension for Safari is actually a separate program. And in order to get those to sync up, because I tend to use 1Password, not Bitwarden or any of the other password managers, but I have the same symptom, which is I have to quit Safari and then launch it again. And that's when my 1Password in Safari and 1Password as an app will sync up and happily work together again. And I bet you would have the same problem with Bitwarden or anything else, because it's really three apps you're running.
Right. Well, I will take some more shots at that. The one thing I did discover, which anybody that had the same problem, when I would click on links in Thunderbird, it would open the wrong browser.
Yes.
And I had just gone back to AVG for my antivirus. And what happened is it installed AVG Safe Browser, in addition to all the other browsers I got on the machine. It's a derivative of Chrome. Well, when I uninstalled the Safe Browser, the problem went away. So it seems like AVG is actually hijacking my links.
I think we've given this advice quite a few times.
Oh, and it's okay.
I don't think for Windows, I don't think that any of the free antivirus programs are worth using. I think using Microsoft Defender, or was it Windows Defender? Windows Defender, as the built-in antivirus is as good as any free antivirus, because as soon as you're using a free antivirus, you're the product, right? Like that, they're going to try and replace ads with their ads, and periodically the press around them is not good,
right? Well, I was late to the game for those things about that problem. So
yeah.
I guess I'm good for now, except if you ever wanted to take a whole half an hour, I could gripe about all the things I don't like about computers in general. And
well, thanks for calling, Dave.
Thank you, gentlemen, and enjoy the eclipse. Stay away from the thruway.
You ain't kidding. Thanks, Dave. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And you're right. When you're mixing programs the way Bitwarden does, there are so many connections between you and it that any one of them could be the problem. And you're right up to a point about the free antivirus programs. The problem I have with Defender is it doesn't update as often as I'd like it to.
Yeah.
That's the only problem I really have with Defender.
If you're running uBlock Origin on your browser,
right,
then in my experience, Defender on Windows updates exactly as often as I need it to.
Oh, does it? Okay.
I mean, I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm not saying it has the
none
best
of them
hit
are.
Rate. But just like Google, right? Like Google's product is your data. That's
right.
What they're selling is your data.
Right.
Using a free antivirus, they're not in it to make the world a better place. They're a business. And what they want to do is change the behavior on your computer, what you do with it.
Right.
So that they or their advertisers or whatever can make money.
Right. Yeah. I have to say I use Clam AV on everything, and that's pretty good. I haven't seen it do anything odd yet. And the emphasis there is on yet.
Well, luckily, with Windows 10 and 11, they have the different kinds of security protections.
Right.
Split up so that you could just use a different antivirus, but still have like their browser protection turned on or their memory corruption stuff turned on.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Fred from Rochester, New York. What's up, Fred? Oh, wait, hold on, Fred. Before we talk to you, I should mention we've gotten an update on some of the people who've donated so far today. We want to thank Dolores, a friend of the show, Dolores, Ralph, Kevin, Greg, William, and Fred. Thanks to each and every one of you for your generous donations. Thank you so much. And you can join them, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. Or pledge securely online at jazz901.org. What's up, Fred?
Well, faster than the speeding bullet, my donation showed up on my credit card.
Excellent. Thank you.
I'm hoping that your phone board is just absolutely swamped, because it took quite a while to get through to give a donation. So anybody that's listening that's having that difficulty, hang in there. It did take a minute, but we got it done.
Thank you.
That's what we like to hear. Thanks. And again, to everybody listening, instead of waiting online, you can always pledge securely online. And trust me, we know it's secure at jazz901.org. Just hit the big red donate now button. You're on your way. Thank you, Fred. What's up?
I want to thank you, Nick, for your advice on NPass. I was listening to the woes of the previous caller. I've had no such problems with NPass. It links up to everything.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
I have it on every device that I ever use.
Yep. Yep.
From phone to Windows to Raspberry Pi to Chromebook, all of that just effortlessly synced up.
Yep, it connects to everything, and it shocked me when it happened.
Yeah.
I expected there was something that wasn't going to work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the people at MPass know what they're doing.
Once you go with synchronized password manager, there's no replacement.
Right.
So I have a couple questions. This is probably in Dave's neighborhood. I'm looking at Money Dance, mm-hmm. and we talked about it before as being free.
Yep.
I'm looking online at it. It's $49.99
for a lifetime.
And then I go down to do the download, and it goes to $65. Am I looking at the right page, or am I looking at something?
Dave, could you remind us what's Money Dance?
Money Dance is a. I was looking. The only thing that was stopping me from going to Linux was I use Quicken. And Money Dance is a free one that looks exactly like Quicken. And I forget what I paid for it, but it sounds about right, between $50 and $60.
Okay.
But I mean, that's for lifetime updates. So okay. No matter how long you keep using it, unlike Quicken that wants a yearly renewal.
Or a subscription, right?
Subscription.
You can go web-based.
It's there. The support is unbelievable for Money Dance.
Okay.
So if you got a question, by all means, shoot them an email. Tell them, hey, I'm seeing this advertised for this price. Let me, but yet when I get to the end, it's saying that it wants this much.
Yeah.
Ask them. They'll get back to you right away. They're very good in support.
Okay, I can do that. I'm gonna put it on my Windows machine first.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can, once I get it established, I can view it on my phone. I've been using just a spreadsheet
mm-hmm.
for keeping track of what's in each account.
Mm-hmm.
Which is sufficient, but not efficient.
Right.
So I was switching to that, and I wanted to double check to make sure I was doing the right thing, because it looked different when I switched screens. And
yeah, once you sign up, they'll send you a key code, and okay. then you're going to have to again on their website is some good instructions on how to go in there and insert your key code, so it knows that you automatically get free updates. No matter what, and support, not everything else.
Okay. So then the next thing I'm trying to do is I'm trying to view my work email on my Windows machine at home. I can view it on my Google app, on my Gmail app. So I have two Gmail accounts and a work account, which is to their Microsoft Office Outlook.
Yeah.
But I can view it on my Google app. I'm not seeing how to do that on my Chrome browser page without going to Outlook.
Yeah, the web-based Outlook.
Yeah. I'm not seeing it. It doesn't come up when I put the email in. It comes up.
Yeah, right. It just takes you into the web-based Outlook, just like, you know, Gmail.
Right.
You should be able to add it to the Windows Mail program.
Yeah, so here's the thing. All Chrome does is show web pages.
Okay.
So it's only going to take you to some app that does mail. Whether that is Gmail Online, which you can, you know, add multiple accounts there.
Right.
Or Outlook Online. That's all Chrome browser does is show web pages. So it's the other end that actually does the work there. So
when I'm in my Gmail and I try to add an account.
Yeah, that's not going to work. Gmail is never going to talk Microsoft Mail. That kind of thing isn't going to line up. That's apples and oranges.
But okay.
You could go into settings on Windows and add another account there. And I believe it'll let you add Gmail accounts, and it'll definitely let you add Microsoft accounts, and then use the built-in mail program that Windows has.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to avoid, because one day I won't have it.
Right, right. And if you want to avoid that, then you really do have to use them as separate apps. They're just not going to play nice together.
Well, you can, in fact, according to Gmail's help.
Yeah, you can pull in Gmail into your Outlook.
And the other way around.
Yeah, oh, really? The other way around.
You can add an Outlook account to Gmail. I will post a link.
But I think at a corporate level, you can
block you're right.
That.
If your business is preventing it, that's separate, and there's nothing we can do about that.
Well, the crazy thing is I can do it on my phone in the Gmail app. Works seamlessly. You know, on your little icon at the top, you pick which account you want to look at.
Yeah.
And I can look at either one of my Gmail accounts or I can look at the work account. And it works perfectly, but I'm not having such luck. When I go to sign in, it just wants me to sign into a Google account.
Yep.
There it's signing into the web browser, whereas on your phone, it's actually signing into an app, which is the Gmail app for just mail. Two different things.
But I think Outlook on the web will let you sign in to Gmail.
Yeah, I don't want to do that. I don't want Outlook. Right. I don't want Windows. I don't want. Right. I didn't want Windows 11 to begin with, except I had to have it for a work software.
Yep.
And I'm preparing everything to when that goes away, that this machine will get wiped out and go to Linux.
Yep. And I don't think Gmail on the web will let you do
what you need to do is create an app specific password in Outlook.
Okay.
And the only way I know to do that is to get your administrator at work involved.
That sounds not ideal.
Yeah, you can't do that on your own, but that's the only way I know to do that.
Yeah, it was like I said, it was so easy on my phone.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. But when you're talking about the web, it's a little different. It's a different code base. And so there you are, but that's pretty much the way you have to do it, I think.
Okay. I'll keep tinkering around with it and seeing if I don't find something that's an alternative. But
if you do find an alternative you like, let us know.
Okay. Yeah, I will.
All right. Good luck.
Good work, guys.
Yep. Thank you.
You can also, of course, forward email, but that's separate.
Right.
That's a separate thing, but you can do that as well.
Right. That doesn't fix the calendaring and
whatever other stuff. Right.
You could also use Thunderbird.
Yeah, when an organization decides what their email thing is going to be, they're not concerned about using something else.
No. Not really at all.
That's an issue that I don't know how to solve that, frankly.
It used to be more of a thing, but now everybody wants, just use the default native app. Use Outlook on the web or the Outlook app, and that's what corporate supports.
Right. And they don't want to know anything else.
Yeah.
And, that's less expensive for them and easier for them, and I get that, I suppose, but that's the way it works. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Walter. Nope, apparently it isn't. Hold on. There we go. Our next caller is Walter from Greece, New York. What's up, Walter?
Yeah, give me a minute.
No, it wasn't you. It was me. I was typing and nothing was happening because I was in a different app.
Well, I wasn't even in the chair.
Well, you don't count. Well, you only have to make the buttons work. And if it, I know you're going to pop me down now.
Now
all right, I apologize. I'm so sorry.
Just remember, who's in control here?
Walter.
Hello, Dick. Can you guys hear me?
Yes,
yeah,
sir.
We can. How's it going?
Okay, very good. I'm hoping I have a series of hopefully easy questions of wanting to install Linux on a brand new computer that is still in the box.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to take it out of the box and turn it on, but anyway, we've been running MX Linux on a number of computers, laptops, and one of the features that they have with MX Linux is a snapshot that you can make of it, which is similar, like you were talking about a couple of weeks ago, about like DD.
Right.
Okay. So that's what I wanted to do, is take that snapshot and put that onto the new computer. The new computer has Windows 11 on the solid-state drive and a separate 1 terabyte SATA spinning drive. And I want to put MX on the SATA drive. I don't want to touch the solid-state drive because it has the diagnostics from the computer manufacturer, etc. But I don't really want to operate Windows 11.
Right.
So just a couple of simple questions, hopefully, that they are. Number one is, do I think when the installation goes on, grub is going to be put onto the ESP portion of the solid state drive. Do you think I have to activate Windows in order for grub to see that?
No.
No. Okay. Perfect.
And I think you could get away with putting Linux on the solid state drive. You don't have to reformat the whole drive. You don't have to wipe it. There should be an option.
Yep.
And a lot of Linux installers will understand that I'm trying to replace Windows. And
no.
it'll leave that recovery partition right
there.
Yeah,
that's separate. That's usually like a ghost image.
Yeah. It's an extra partition.
Yeah, but it doesn't bother me, like to say, to leave it there because it's a terabyte SATA drive and I can do all the stuff there. Just put it all in there. So then really the next question is, okay, we don't have to boot the Windows. Great. Now, the laptop that I'm taking the mirror that snapshot from is going to, it's already has Windows. I've already partitioned that. I've done that. Mm-hmm. It's in UEFI mode.
Yep.
But it's also, I've also disabled secure boot and the fast boot. Now, do I have to do the same thing to the BIOS on the new computer?
I think for MX Linux, unless they are shipping a kernel that is signed so that it would support secure boot, you will have to disable secure boot. I doubt fast boot really matters.
No, that shouldn't.
Yeah, if you're going to leave Windows there as a bootable operating system, then maybe you do. Or at least, yeah, that sounds like probably the right thing.
I have not had a problem with secure boot or anything else on machines.
Okay.
Most of the major distributions of Linux will support secure boot, but not all of them.
Right. And I'm afraid I don't have enough
in the fast
knowledge
boot,
about MX Linux.
I could see the BIOS saying, when it comes, you turn the computer on and the BIOS says, okay, which operating system am I supposed to hand off to? Why don't I just look for what do I have first and fastest? And that's going to be the NVMe.
Uh-huh.
And if Windows is on there, your BIOS could easily say, well, this must be the right choice, so, even if you wanted to pick up Linux on the SATA drive.
Right. So what I understand of MX Linux is when you create a snapshot, it really creates an ISO.
Right.
And that ISO is bootable.
Right.
And included in that ISO is a standard installer.
Correct. And that's what I plan to do. Yes.
So when, and in every installer I've ever used, and again, I have not personally used MX Linux, but in every installer I've ever used, one of the things it does is it comes up and says, oh, you've already got Windows on this machine. Do you want to wipe it out or do you want to live alongside it?
Yeah.
Right.
And you just say live alongside it and you can install it anywhere you want.
Right.
And then grub will handle that. The big thing for anybody listening is that it's better to install Windows first than to and then Linux second.
Yes.
Because while the grub installer understands Windows,
it'll play nice.
The Windows installer doesn't necessarily understand Linux and will wipe it out.
Right. Right. Well, that's fascinating. So your MX Linux backup is a ISO. Can you put that right on a USB stick and then you boot off of that on the new computer and the installer just installs Linux and it's got all your stuff on there? That's very impressive.
Yeah, you're essentially creating a bespoke image of your system and
with
putting
it
on another machine. Now, the problem with that for anybody listening is if the machines are radically different because all your drivers are going to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with Linux, the drivers are going to fix themselves. You'd have a problem if it's AMD versus ARM.
Right. First boot up is going to be the problem.
Yeah.
Until you update and fix.
It'll be great.
Right.
Yeah, you shouldn't have a problem.
Okay. Well, I do have one last quick question, though.
Oh, hold on. Stay on the line because we got to take a break, but we'll come back to you after the break, okay?
Okay, thank you.
All right. We're going to take a quick break back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Chris Horn, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 29 minutes after the hour. It's Soundbites. It's time to make a pledge while we take a break back in just a couple of minutes.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I am the new and improved Eclipse-enabled Chris Horn.
And at 34 minutes after the hour, We are Sound Bites, and we have Walter still on the line. So what's up, Walter?
Okay, it's a very last question. That is basically to make sure that the grub, you know, the booting, when I have to shut down and reboot in order to get fully activate the Linux system, that's when I would have to be able to right click update grub in order to see if the Windows will be a choice yet, or do you think the Windows will not be seen because I have not activated it?
Oh, it'll be seen.
Yeah, it should be seen.
Right, it's the type of partition
okay.
that grub will recognize. It doesn't matter whether or not Windows is activated.
Okay, that's perfect, yeah. As far as the other part we were talking about earlier about the disabling secure boot, from what I understand, all of them, the most modern Linuxes seem to, as Nick was saying, seem to ignore that need to disable secure boot, that they seem to run pretty well with that.
Yep.
So, right. Most of them do.
Yeah. And the part that always, I'm such an old person with it, I was looking at, thought I'd have to use GParta just to go ahead and look at SATA drive, and it's like, no, I don't got to do that. I don't have to deflag that it's going to boot.
You're just showing your experience.
No, I'm showing my age for using Linux that long as well.
I like my version better. You're just experience.
Okay. Well, thank you. You're very, very kind. Thank you. Well, thank you. You've been very helpful to me. I hope they sound like they were easy questions. I should have no problem. Thank you.
Excellent. You're have fun.
Thank you.
Thanks, take Walter. Care. Yeah. And you can, of course, give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. And shockingly, those are also the numbers you can use to pledge to our pledge drive. We want to thank everyone who's already pledged. And if you haven't pledged, why not? If you don't want to talk to Michael, who is a lovely human being to talk to, you can also pledge securely online at jazz901.org. And believe me, it is secure. We made sure it's secure. You can trust it. And there are multiple levels. And, of course, you can also make a monthly donation. And let's say you pledge and at a minimum of $10 a month. But let's say you decide to pledge $10 a month. That's a $120 pledge. You get that's the nice T-shirt level. It's as if you pledged $120 all at once. You can get the lovely T-shirt, and you can see what the stuff is online to get. And while you do that, while you make your pledge, and you should be making your pledge, we're going to talk to Mike from Henrietta, New York. Hi, Mike. What's up?
Yeah, I'm a member already.
Lovely.
Gee, time flies. You guys are doing it again. That's been a year already, man.
Yeah.
Time zips so long.
Well, we go twice a year.
But it's... I wonder if you could help me out and did something. I don't know if this is stupid or not. I don't think so. I hope not. But that's what I'm calling. I sent an email to a congressman complaining about something, but it was the template that was on his site. You know, you fill in your name, et cetera,
right.
et cetera. And the body of the email. So I wanted to save it because I wanted to use it for a senator. And so I saved it to Google Docs. And then I went back in, and the only thing that it saved was the template itself, and the body of the email is gone. I don't know if I can get that back somehow or not. That's why I'm calling you. If it's hidden away, I've looked everywhere on the computer searching, et cetera, and it's
can't find it. Was that an email that you sent, or was it a form you filled out on their website?
Yeah, that's the form, yeah. It was a form that's what it was saved. I thought it was saved the whole thing as a file. But it just saved the template, and you get down to the body of the email, and it's blank.
If it was just a form on their website that you filled out, I don't think you can get that back.
Yeah, that's what I was afraid of. That's why I wanted to give you guys a call. I was curious also, you do run into this once in a while. It looks like it's on their end. I'm from the national end, the guy that's in Washington. It when you get down to the bottom of them and you're all done, sign it, blah, 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 and it goes next and it has the CAPTCHA. And sometimes it won't catch it. It won't be there. So it tells you, we can't find it, blah, 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 reload it and redo it. And I said, well, wait a minute. Yeah, it's gone. So I don't know if that's their end that's sloppy.
It's their end.
Yeah, it's not you. Yeah.
That's okay. Not you.
Bad code.
One thing you might be able to do, and I'm not going to promise this, but if you go back to that form and click in it, it may be that your it depends on their end whether they block this.
Yeah.
But it may be that your browser saved what you put in. So if you click in there, it might drop down a drop down menu with the text in it.
I see.
Again, I'm not going to promise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not impossible that it did that. So you can try that, but it's the only thing that might work.
So if you wanted to use something and not have to redo it, you'd have to just send a regular email. I don't know if
or you write it in a text editor and then save that and then cut and paste.
Oh, I got you. Okay, good. All right, sir. I'll try it. Thanks a lot.
All right, go for it. Good luck, Mike.
I know.
Yeah, most of the form fill out things don't allow you to save information that way, but some
yeah, do. That's where if it just to be cautious. You know, like Windows has that snippet tool.
Yep.
If you can fit it all on the screen, you can quick sit there, use the snippet, and select the whole form. And it's like taking a screenshot.
It's basically a screenshot.
Yeah.
And I believe,
you could just, once you've written the thing, highlight all of it, copy, and paste it into a document.
Yeah.
As soon as I start writing something in a form like that, where I'm like, all right, I don't want to have to type this again, I've learned to copy-paste it into a doc. But I think Windows 11, maybe Windows 10, also has a copy-paste history it'll keep for you.
Oh, maybe.
You have to turn it on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it might not help them for now, but yeah.
And I don't think that the Mac has tools that'll let you do that kind of thing, and I'm sure Linux has copy-paste history kinds of tools, but again, that's
good.
A whole thing you got
to
set
up.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Can't retroactively do that, unfortunately.
Right. Mike might be out of luck this time.
But it's annoying because you go to a text editor and you start typing it in, and then the form, the login there times out.
Right.
And you've lost your spot. It's a chicken and egg kind of thing.
Right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Larry from Rochester, New York. What's up, Larry?
Good afternoon, guys. I have a problem. I went to my Google Drive a couple of days ago, and I was just clearing out some old files and things that I could delete. Somehow I deleted a flyer, and every time I delete it now, it instantly pops back up in my trash. I'll delete it out of trash, and within 10 seconds, I got the little download sign that it's downloaded back in now. So I can't seem to get rid of that. I've tried some things that I could, but I have no idea what's going on now.
Generally speaking, that happens when either A, you didn't own the file, or B, you shared it with someone else and they still are using it. So what you need to do is go into the file itself and see who you've shared it with, stop sharing it with them, and then you can get rid of it.
Okay, because it's just an old Little League flyer from 2017.
Right, but if you shared it with anybody, it won't let you delete it because you shared it and they still might need it.
Are you doing this with like the Google Drive running on your computer, or are you doing it all on the web?
It's a Google Drive running on my computer. It's on a Facebook account that we don't use anymore.
If you try it from the web, oddly enough, when you do stuff on the web version of Google Drive, it's more authoritative. Right. So if you say no, really, delete this, it'll delete it or complain that it doesn't work. Where on your computer, because it's trying to make all of this synchronization stuff seamless, whatever, it can quietly fail and not tell you.
Right.
Okay, so I have on my desktop a folder that's got the Google Drive on it. There's a little Google Drive symbol on it.
Yep.
Now, is that the one that's on the network?
Well, what you want to do is go to your browser and go to drive.google.com and sign in there is what Chris is saying.
Okay. All right, well, let me do that. I'm furiously taking notes here, and... I'll do that and I'll see what happens, because this is just one flyer is driving me nuts now. I want to get rid of it.
Well, more nuts, Larry.
Well, thank you very much.
He resembles that.
Well, if it doesn't work, we're just going to say that it's Steve's fault because he's not here today.
Exactly. Okay. This is Steve's fault.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Larry.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Bye-bye. Yeah. There's the beauty of these online repositories is that you can get at them anywhere. You can share them with people. You can do all kinds of wonderful things with it. The problem with them is there's a lot of mystery in the background. And I've seen this before where you've shared something with somebody and you can't delete it. I've also seen where I went to look for something and it was gone. And then I realized, oh, yeah, I didn't write that. Such and so wrote that, and they probably deleted it.
Yeah.
They probably unshared it with me, whether they deleted it or not. I don't know.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
The more complicated these things are, well, let me say this a different way. The stuff that we really find valuable are really very complicated behind the scenes. And when they go wrong, it's often a mystery.
And we see that with... specifically with Wi-Fi problems. You go through so many, and internet in general. Oh, I can't get to this site. You know what?
Yeah.
There's 50 connections between you and that site.
Yeah.
I don't know what to tell you. If you can get to other sites, it's not you, and that's the best we can tell you. That's just the way that works.
Yeah.
Is it their end? I don't know. Is it somebody in the middle? I don't know.
Could be.
And there are ways that we can find out to a point, right? I mean, you can do a trace route and say, oh, yeah, it failed in Idaho somewhere. But you don't know who that is in Idaho.
We're not
you know
even
why
talking
that
about,
is in Idaho.
DNS, because there's 100 ways DNS can be wrong.
Right. So, yeah, there's just, you know, many of the problems that we can't solve are because there are so many factors involved in dealing with them, and Wi-Fi as well. Well, we see that when people say, I can't get an internet connection in this part of my house.
Yeah.
Well, what's between you and the router? If it's a whole load of pipes, that's right. You can't get an internet connection there. And that's just something you have to visualize. You know, if you're on the other side of the refrigerator, or, you know, if you're in between the hot water pipes, if the hot water pipes are in between you and the router, you may get a poor or no signal.
Well, that's all the mesh networks are. Basically, an invisible set of pipes.
Right.
Giving you capacity in those weird spots of your house.
One of the things that I really like is there are a couple of programs for your phone that will tell you what the signal strength is at any point.
Yeah.
So you can walk around your house and essentially make a map.
It's like Ghostbusters.
It's like Ghostbusters. You know where the signal is, where the ghosts are in that part of the house. I've said this many times before. We live in a very old house, and one of the walls is curved, and that's chicken wire in there making that curve.
Yes.
So when I get into the library in my house, yes, I have a library. It doesn't have a bat cave behind it, sadly. But once I get into the library, I have no signal. Because where my router is, is on the other side of that chicken wire wall. Yeah. So, you know, that's just the way it works. And I've had to put in a mesh network where the mesh router, not called router.
Satellite,
thank you. Where the mesh satellite can see the router and also see into the library.
Yeah.
And so that's the only way I could get a signal into the library. But I happen to know, you know, the first time I went in, I had no signal. I thought, what the? Oh, and there's that curved wall.
Nick, I'm disappointed that you didn't break into the wall and hook into the chicken wire and make the chicken wire act as an antenna.
Well, don't laugh, because when I moved into that house 40 years ago, there were no mesh networks, and I seriously considered that. Not jokingly.
I'm not jokingly saying I'm super disappointed in you, because this is the way I wanted the story to go. And now, you know, this one wall of your house is now partially parabolic.
Taking that stuff out, though, is such an SOB.
Yeah.
Oh, no way.
I did. My house is like Nick's. My house was built in 1928. And where I have the computers, it was the dining room, but we set it up as our computer room. Back in the day there, I didn't want a door swinging into the kitchen or into this computer room because it was hung so it would swing and it'd be bumping at me. So I thought, okay, I'm going to put in a sliding door.
Oh, yeah.
A pocket door.
Yeah.
Well, I had to cut it into the wall, 36 inches.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had to cut through there. I went through two circular saw blades.
What?
Cutting through that plaster and chicken wire.
Back in the day, that stuff, and they built to last.
And then you get into the lath part. Oh, that was so old and brittle.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a bear to do, but I got it done.
My house, the walls are cement block.
Holy cow.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's the right reaction, too.
Well, yeah. Some of them, yeah, they did it for a fire break. And some, townhouses and all that, there was required code from one townhouse to the next to the next.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure my house is hurricane proof in a part of the country that doesn't need
probably
that.
Probably bomb proof.
Yeah.
Well, we had that at RIT. Our building is all the famous RIT brick. Yeah. And so we had to put hotspots in every room.
Repeater.
Every single room because
It just wouldn't work.
You
otherwise.
Couldn't just get classrooms, particularly. We could put them in the every few feet in the hall for offices.
Yeah,
but for the classrooms, we had to drill, and those drills aren't cheap.
Yeah,
we had to drill through the wall. You know this. You've probably done it. And then you stick a hotspot up in the ceiling, and then you can get the room.
Mm-hmm.
And you're insulated from all the other rooms because there's rebar in those walls.
Yep.
And it's blocking signals from one room to another. So that was actually kind of nice. It actually made it easier when you didn't have to say,
sound like your name.
You know, block this from that, okay, from the other. Because they're all essentially Faraday cages.
Yeah.
Every room.
Yeah.
So the Faraday cage blocks all signals in or out. So if you're in a Faraday cage, you get no outside. It's the chicken wire in our wall. It essentially makes a Faraday wall, not a whole cage, but it blocks signals. That's the way that works. So there's a whole lot of it's a whole lot to the invisible world that we have to deal with before we can get these things working. Back to the phones. Our next caller is Steve from Greece, New York. What's up, Steve?
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon,
thank you, Nick. I had a friend who actually had that same chicken wire issue.
Yep.
And what I had her do was get a Wi-Fi extender.
Yep.
To go basically past the chicken wire so it could come back into the room from the other side.
Yep.
And
yep.
That worked fine. We didn't have to do any special mesh stuff or anything like that. We just came in the room from the other side.
Yep. That makes sense. That's exactly how it works.
Yeah, I mean, the mesh network stuff is just a fancier take on the repeaters.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's, you know, when you have a mesh network, all of them work together for line of sight only, and that's what people forget.
Yeah.
Any computer that you connect to the router has to be able to see the router. And through a floor or a wall is not a problem as long as there's nothing metallic blocking that signal, because then you can't see it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're absolutely right. That's the sort of thing that works.
Yep, it was, we'll go past it and come back.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I did with mine. It was, I put the satellite where it could see upstairs, where the router is, but it was also past the chicken wire, so it could see into the library. And provide connectivity in there. Absolutely, that's you have to. And I've seen houses where you're in one room and you're fine. You go into the other room and you can't get anything. Well, guess what? All the water pipes are going through that wall,
or
a wiring harness. You can't know what's in the walls and how they're going to affect the Wi-Fi signal until. So that's why I walk around with that little program on my phone that tells me where and when the signal drops.
Yeah, this was 7-8 years ago. I wasn't even thinking mesh networks back then.
Yeah, right.
I don't think mesh networks were any good back then.
No, they weren't. No, they absolutely weren't.
All right,
thanks, Steve.
Yep, you guys have a good day.
You too. Keep smiling.
I think the fascinating thing with the mesh networks is that, let's say you've got a two-lane highway. The way the mesh networks work is that internally it's a four-lane highway. So they have two lanes just to talk to each other and keep that connection working so that your two-lane part of the highway is reasonably fast.
Yep. I first really saw the use of a mesh network back. Remember the old EPCs? There was this thing where you bought a laptop and you actually paid for two of them. And then one of them went to an underprivileged country.
Yeah.
And it created a mesh network. So they just needed one person somewhere in the area with network connectivity. And each EPC was a point in the mesh network. And so they could all talk to each other. And I thought, man, that's clever. Why aren't we seeing that in routers? And then eventually we were.
Yeah.
I can see where it wasn't necessary back in the day. You had one laptop in a house.
Yep.
And that's all that was on the network.
Yep.
Nowadays, you've got your tablets and your phones and your laptops and your televisions and your radios and your clocks and your thermostats. It's everything.
Yeah.
And so having Wi-Fi connectivity that's ubiquitous in your home is important. I remember at one point having to put a repeater out on a back window because my wife wanted to sit out by the pond and do Facebook farming, whatever the thing was. And she couldn't get a signal out there until I put a repeater in the one place that she could see from the house.
So you've got a library, a pond. Do you have a conservatory also?
I do not.
I'm just trying to figure out if you moved into a house that you're trying to be like Clue, the board game. Are there secret doors or secret passages?
I have not found any secret passage. We do have pocket doors.
Yeah.
Two big sets of them.
Yeah. Professor Plum ever visited?
I'm just looking for Miss Scarlet. Never mind Professor Plum. But yeah, it's a beautiful old house. And I am honored to be living in it, although I have to admit at this point in my life, the stairs are not my friends as much as they used to be. But we've got stained glass windows and we've got all kinds of really lovely. It's a lovely old house, and I'm very honored to have lived there for 40 years. It's a great place. I love my house. I really do.
So no secret doors, though?
No. There's a crawl space in the attic, but. There's nothing in there.
10-year-old version of me is very disappointed in adult version of me that I don't have
version of me is
a zip line or secret doors. Or
I know, right?
A bat pole.
That's the thing I really wanted was a bat pole, and I didn't get one, and I'm very upset about that. But it's a beautiful house, and I'm honored to live there. It's a great place. But it has, you know, old houses have their challenges. And ours did. Yeah. There was a point at which I was contemplating drilling through the floors to drop cable.
Yeah.
Down through the floors back when Wi-Fi was not really a thing.
Sure. And slow enough, or Wi-Fi was slow enough where you didn't really want to use it to copy files.
Well, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I didn't mind waiting for a web page to come up.
Right.
But I wasn't going to do any real work.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, that's it. We are done for another week. I want to thank everybody who called in. I particularly want to thank everybody who pledged. God bless each and every one of you. I want to thank Dave Van Rundy. I really want to thank Chris Horn, who, you know, we forced to come in here today. But he was pretty gracious about it anyway. And he has a lot of information in his head, and we just ripped some of it out to
share
with you.
Some of it's true.
And some of it's even true. I'm Nick Francesco. Please, you can still pledge online. You can pledge online all week, particularly you people who download the podcast. Get online, pledge. We'll see you next week. Enjoy the eclipse. And we will see you in just 166 hours. Be good to one another, will you?